Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Dr. Kiki's Science Hour with Dr. Kiki Sanford, episode 44 for Monday, May 3rd, 2010, How to Teach a Brain. Welcome, everyone. This is Dr. Kiki's Science Hour, the hour of science in which we talk with one expert on one topic for the entire hour. When does this happen, right? Nowhere else but right here on twit.tv. And I'm Dr. Kiki. I'm the host of the show. I am joined today by Dr. Chris Kello from UC Merced. He is Assistant Professor of Cognitive and Information Sciences. And we're going to be talking today about how to teach a brain. That's the question. How do you teach a brain? And this question is pertinent for, you know, ourselves with the brain that's inside of our head, but it's also pertinent for the question of developing artificial intelligence and computer systems or robots with synthetic brains. How do we teach them to learn? How do we teach them the things that they will need to know to be able to do the things that we'd like them to do? So hopefully we will get to the nut of that question today during this conversation. Now, DARPA has funded a project called the Synapse Project. And within Synapse, they are looking to create a synthesized brain, the size and power of the human brain. Sounds amazing, right? Our brain, I've got some numbers here. Currently, in real world situations, programmable machines are basically less efficient by a factor of 1 to 1 million or 1 billion times. It's huge. The efficiency factor is just, it's just not there. Currently, most recently, they have simulated the cortex of a rat, and a rat cortex. I'm not exactly sure how many neurons and synapses exist within the rat cortex, but a rat brain is significantly smaller from mine and your brain too. So we're going to find out what challenges lie ahead. And Chris Kello, he works in the area of behavior and computation. And so how can we take behavior and computation and then teach this synthetic brain to work? So Chris, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks, Dr. Kiki, for having me here today.
You're welcome. Sure. So off the bat, let's talk a little bit about how the human brain, since that's what, you know, the ultimate goal is going to be, is to make something like our own brain, right? what are we looking at right now? How we're trying to mimic it. So how's the human brain built and how are we trying to get there?
Right. So in this project, we are basically paying attention to cortex. So when you think about the human brain, or any brain for that matter, any mammalian brain, you've got subcortical structures and you've got cortical structures and the neocortex, which is basically the most evolved part of the human brain.
Yeah.
So if you're going to try to match human intelligence, most people go to look at the cortex because this is, and especially the neocortex, and especially the front part of the cortex, so the prefrontal cortex, which is basically right behind your forehead, because these are the parts that are, you know, appear to separate us from other species, right?
Right.
So in this project called Synapse, what we're doing is basically trying to get basic design principles of cortex, extract them from what we know from the neuroscience, and put them into nanoscale hardware. For a long time, this will be an exercise in getting things to work. In other words, just getting it not to crash, if you will.
we have that problem here a lot.
Yeah. And our, you know, our circuits crash all the time, basically. So, you know, and I want to say that kind of right up front, because a lot of times when people hear about this kind of work, they think, you know, this is the beginning of the end. It's Terminator. It's Skynet. basically, we're going to, you know, before we know it, we're going to have computers enslaving humanity and effects, you know, anything
as
far from the truth as it could possibly be. Also, you know, I don't know how we'll walk into it, but at some point I'll be telling you about what we're doing, like you sort of started the show today, what we're doing to try to train these circuits. And we put them to basically cut right to the chase. We put them in virtual environments. And again, I want to emphasize right up front, when you're dealing with a virtual environment, a lot of people immediately go to the idea of first-person shooter games. You know, Doom is the original one, and now you got World of Warcraft, and et cetera, et cetera. And these virtual environments look like places where you go and shoot things. And again, very, very far from the truth. We're using virtual environments because they're very manipulable, not because we want to sort of train circuits to shoot things or anything like that.
Right. So those are the stories that people can come up with. But yes, the reality is you need something that is easy to build, that you're not actually having to put something out in the real world.
Right.
You know, or build it something. I mean, I can imagine building a whole town. Here, robot, here's your town.
Right. And you know, you may know that DARPA, the same agency that's funding us, has funded a ton of work and continues to fund a ton of work on robots. And robots, you know, and figuring out how to get robots to do useful things in the real world. Again, let's not, for example, at UC Merced, there's a robotics group that's working on urban search and rescue robots. You know, it's very, basically going into situations where you don't want to risk human life, but you think if a robot could get in there and save some human lives and we don't have to sort of worry so much about if the robot, you know, falls apart or gets crushed or whatever, that's a wonderful endeavor, right? The problem is, for our project, the distinction is that in that situation, you're spending most of your time on dealing, the nitty-gritties of dealing with the physical world, right? The challenges of dealing with the physics of the world, gravity and friction and all of these factors, which, again, are very important problems. But if you're interested in intelligence, or if you're interested in cortex and cognition and behavior, those are details that you'd like to, at least for in the beginning, put aside to some extent. And a virtual environment basically lets you do that. It lets you do the kind of like robotics work, but without doing all the hard robotics work of dealing with the physical world.
Actually building the robot.
Actually,
that's
and
going
getting
to
it,
move
yeah, and again, the... getting it to not, you know, fall over, for example, or getting it to be able to go up a slope when it's supposed to be able to go up that slope and all of that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Right. I read that you are using, where did I read this? That you are using a system, and I've completely lost it in my notes now. Where did it go?
I can probably remind you.
You probably can. what system, since I've lost it, what system are you using for this virtual world environment?
So there's two layers of it. So one layer is something that a lot of gamers out there would be familiar with, Unreal Tournament. So Unreal Tournament, again, as soon as you say that, people think shooting. But Unreal Tournament basically provides a really good physics engine for building virtual environments. It's a layer of code so that when we do it, we don't have to deal with the nitty-gritties of video cards, for example, joystick control and so on. They've taken care of all that, all the 3D rendering, the lighting, and et cetera, right? So we use the Unreal Tournament engine as a base layer. Then there's a second layer on top of that, and that's something called USAR Sim, or Urban Search and Rescue Simulator. And that's what I just referred to a couple of minutes ago. Stefano Carpin at UC Merced, he's a professor in electrical engineering, and he's developed this virtual environment. Again, what's interesting about it is he's developed it for real robots, for building real robots that would go into urban search and rescue situations, but basically testing them, prototyping them in the virtual environment first before you do the more expensive and extensive tests out in the real world. So so what I'm saying is that this virtual environment, because this second layer that's sitting on top of Unreal Tournament, because it's designed for real robots, it actually has the physics of the world built into it. And we can basically dial that up or down depending on how much of that detail we want to deal with.
Right. So
it's a nice platform for us to work
in. That sounds neat. So you have the platform already set up. It's got all of the parameters set for this is Earth.
And we can
build it. You can say
we
want
Mars if we want. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Less gravity, more gravity, or what job is this robot supposed to do? Right. Let's put them in that simulated environment and then Now let's play with the behavior.
Right. Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
So we get past the question of where you teach the robots.
Yes.
How do you simulate this world?
Right.
Where do you teach them? You put them in this unreal place.
Right.
And then the question is, how do you teach them? What do you teach them?
Right.
So,
from
your lab and your work, mm-hmm. What kind of behavioral information is important for you to try and be able to look mm-hmm. at and then pass on to a robot?
Sure. So, a lot of this is actually somewhat dictated by DARPA, because when they put out the call for this competition mm-hmm. to fund a project like this, they said in very loose terms what they wanted the robot to learn, if you will, and what
right.
the kind of behavior. And so I can list it for you. It's pretty simple. It's perception. So these are sort of basic functions of your sensory systems to be able to take information in and recognize what you're looking at, mm-hmm. Categorize it, identify it, and then act accordingly. So okay. that you could sort of roughly categorize that kind of learning as perception. We've got
right.
navigation. Again, a very simple, you know, I shouldn't say simple, an ecologically important behavior, right? Being able to get around in the world.
Can you get from one point to another?
Yes.
Do you just go in circles?
That's right. It may seem simple, you know, from the perspective of human intelligence. That's what I was thinking is, you know, in math and language and all the kinds of things that you associate with human intelligence compared with other species. But in fact, first of all, navigation, again, it's a basis for our mm-hmm. intelligence. And you know, we can go into it in however much detail you want, but there's a lot of good evidence to show that spatial cognition, this processes mm-hmm. that are developed in mammalian species, let's say,
okay.
are being used for human intelligence. So when we do math, for example, there is a sense that, you know, think about geometry, right? There's a sense that you're using the systems that you've built for dealing with space mm-hmm. and you've abstracted them and now you're using them to deal with math. Okay, and there's
right.
tons and tons of events along these lines. So navigation is a good kind of task, a good kind of function to be working with. So we've got perception, navigation, and then you've got what's probably the most complicated would be something planning/decision-making. So
yeah.
this is probably where you really start to touch upon what we might think of as one of the things that makes us a little bit special compared to other species, that we're able to premeditate, right? We're able to think ahead, and not to say that other species aren't, they are too, but perhaps we're a lot better at it.
Right.
Able to sort of plan out a route, plan out a course of action, plan out contingencies, and then execute actions that go in accordance with the plan and then change as the situation, you know, changes. So those are at least are the three kinds. So I haven't answered the question how we're actually going to do this.
but this is what's important.
But you need to know this. You need to know that that's at least what we're going to try to get the robots to mm-hmm. learn in this virtual environment. Learn perceptual skills, learn navigational skills, and planning or decision-making skills.
Okay.
Do you want me to just keep going?
You've got so much to say. I love it.
I mean, you can just guide me as I go. So now the question is how. So the virtual environment affords the opportunity to create a learning situation that's not unlike what happens when humans or other organisms learn.
Mm-hmm.
You are born and you have perhaps some amount of knowledge or at least a potential for knowledge that's somehow in the genetics. And then you basically over development, you've got maturation processes that kick in and sort of time the sort of development of, in this case, let's say cortex in the brain. And then those processes are guided or affected by your experience as you learn over time. So the virtual environment at least provides that opportunity to create something like a different kind of learning than what would happen with, for example, a computer program, where learning, at least traditionally, well, there really isn't learning. You just basically type the knowledge into the program, right?
Right, where that's just the traditional robot or the traditional program
right.
does what you tell it to.
Right, right.
And so this is what is what separates artificial intelligence from just computer intelligence.
Right. That's right. I mean, there probably are areas of artificial intelligence where the trick is to write an algorithm that mimics some intelligent behavior. In other words, learning may not be involved. But I would mm-hmm. say you're right that the majority of the field of artificial intelligence is interested in learning and adaptation, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you don't want to have to basically the whole point in some sense is not to program the knowledge in, but to have that knowledge emerge through these interactions, through learning mechanisms and interactions with an environment, or at least some kind of experience. Right. In our case, it would be the environment.
Right. And so I'm thinking right now of so many examples of where we see people working on this. For me, the language learning robots that are online, where you can have a conversation with a robot, and they've gotten so much more advanced over the last few years, and that's all based on the trial and error and the learning and the increase in their lexicon of verbal knowledge.
Right.
Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, interestingly, notice that I didn't say language as one of the kinds of behaviors that we're going to be looking at.
Yeah.
I can imagine if this project is successful, we may, 5 years, 7 years down the road, start to look at language or other kinds of symbolic knowledge, symbolic reasoning, because language would appear to be a kind of symbolic knowledge or reasoning.
Right.
In some sense, the idea here is that, go in order of evolution. Start with what's evolutionarily simple, relatively speaking, and build up to something like language. Now, trial and error. So you mentioned trial and error as a kind of learning mechanism. So in our circuits, right now we've sort of envisioned roughly three kinds of learning mechanisms, and trial and error would be one of them.
Okay.
So for starters, we have something, and in the machine learning world, this is all sort of very standard, but we just, we need to sort of embody that in these robots. One is something called unsupervised learning mechanisms. So these would be, unlike trial and error, these would be mechanisms that learn just purely by osmosis, is sort of a way to think about it, purely by soaking it in, take experience in.
How everyone would love to be able to learn when, putting their textbook up against their head.
That would be nice. So, but guess what? There are parts of your brain that do learn like that. They're more unconscious. They're not at the level of learning for a test, right? But they are at the level of, for example, we know now that there are, you mentioned language, there are basic kinds of language learning that are going on at 6 months old that are of that osmosis variety, where a baby is basically tuned to receive this input, language input, and immediately start picking up on the statistics of that input. In other words, how often things occur? When do things occur with each other? When do they not occur with each other? Because that kind of statistical learning, first of all, can be done in an unsupervised fashion. You don't need a teacher. You don't need trial and error. And you can learn a lot about a language just by paying attention to when things happen and when they happen together or not, basically.
Oh, I'm just thinking right now about just animal models of behavior. From my own background, birdsong is a very solid model for human language production. And then again, spatial learning and memory, looking at rats, looking at migratory birds, looking at food caching birds. We can, the list goes on, and it goes down to the, I won't say lowly, but the small aplysia, the sea slug, the point. And I think the aplysia is where we start getting at the reductionist level of determining how behavior or learning takes place. What levels of, these, there's language, there's, these complex behaviors that are, taking up massive amounts of computing power in our brains, and very complex systems. How are you looking at this? Are you looking at human behavior? Are you looking at the aplysia, or looking at research that other people have done for...
So this is interesting. So for starters, there was a sense in the project, and we don't actually know how this is going to go. So I'm just going to sort of basically make some conjectures here.
Okay.
We were thinking that you would look at certain animal models, maybe not starting with aplysia, but perhaps certainly starting with a rat, and maybe even earlier than a rat. But I think rats are pretty good models. For example, as you heard, when you talk about perception, navigation, and planning, those are all functions that have been studied in rat models,
and that's very thoroughly.
So that's not a coincidence. I think when people were putting these ideas together for this project, they were thinking that, you know, the rat model could be a place to start and try to build up from there. So let me just throw out an idea, though. So another approach that we've been thinking about is to basically always benchmark against human performance. So, which is, you know, making a huge leap, but the virtual environment gives you a way to do this, potentially at least. And again, this is early days and we're not really sure how this is going to work out. We may end up falling back on rat models and that'd be great. But here's what the virtual environment allows you to do is basically you can take the robot and you can either have a circuit control the robot or you can have a person control the robot.
Okay.
You can give a task to the circuit, go find the cheese, go find, you know, go home or do whatever you need to do. And you can do the same thing with a person and be essentially like a really simple video game. Think of it that way, right? That you could have a person play or you could have the circuit play.
Or you could have a monkey with a brain-computer interface.
You could do that too. Absolutely.
Go find the Cheerios.
That's right. It sounds like you're aware of a lot of research that's going on these days. It's exactly along those lines. But so in this case, let's just imagine, you know, monkeys aren't part of the project, at least not yet.
Right.
But getting people involved at this level, just, hey, come on and grab the joystick and here, I'm going to give you some instructions. Go ahead and perform this task for me. Very easy to do. What we can do now is basically say, okay, fine. I can create a benchmark based against human performance and see how the circuits do relative to human performance. Now, the first thought that you should have and anybody listening should have is basically, wait a minute. These circuits are not going to perform at the level of a person, at least. And they certainly will not, probably in my lifetime is my guess. But again, this is something really interesting about the virtual environment. What it allows you to do is basically, in some sense, dial down the complexity of the task, dial down the complexity of the environment, make it so simple that at some point the circuit does become indistinguishable from the person. So even in other words, one way you can think of that is you've made things so easy that both the circuit and the person are essentially successful. They perform what we call at ceiling, right? So they basically they get 100% right and they do it pretty much at some, you know, moderate speed such that you can't really distinguish the circuit from the person. Okay, maybe at that point that's not particularly interesting, but again, with a virtual environment, with all these parameters that we kind of talked about earlier, what you can now do is start to make things a little harder. And the question is, when does the circuit start to diverge from the person? When do you start to be able to see a difference between a person and a circuit? Now you have a benchmark. You have a way of, in any given situation, as long as you have your knobs right, as long as you have the kind of basically the parameters that dial up or down the complexity of a task, then you can set the knobs and you can just say, okay, your circuit is working at some particular level of, let's call it, you know, IQ or the VEIQ for virtual environment IQ. That circuit is working at this level of IQ, and what that would mean is that I could turn the knob up to this point before I can tell the difference between a person and the circuit. It gives you this continuum, call it a virtual continuum, I don't know. It gives you this continuum between, you know, really simple performance that would be at the rat level, let's say, or maybe, I don't know, at the aplasia level practically. but without using those models, because basically you can just sort of, the human's always at the ceiling, and you're just using these knobs to kind of like go up and down from that ceiling. Basically.
Okay, so you're just trying to dial in exactly what factors and what components of the system really play into determining the resulting behavior.
Right. Okay. That's basically it.
So a term that I found on your website and also in papers that you have written is the idea of biologically analogous systems.
Okay.
So is this, can you explain what you mean by that? And is this idea of creating a virtual environment that's theoretically analogous to the real world the behavioral, the way that something responds? Is that
I'm guessing they probably weren't my papers, but that's okay. That's okay. I think I can go with it. So there is a term called biomimetic.
Yes.
That's very common in, well, no, I shouldn't say it that way. It's becoming very common.
Okay.
And I think it's what you're talking about. When you say biologically analogous, biomimetic, I think we can interchange those two. So if you don't mind, I'll answer that question, which is
perfect.
A biomimetic system.
I'd love it.
Which is very relevant to what we're doing here. So basically, the whole idea of biomimetics, not just in our project, but throughout the science and engineering worlds, is looking to biology where you can see functions, you know, not just artificial intelligence, but any function that looks useful, and trying to draw by analogy, kind of like you said, or by whatever means you can, trying to draw inspiration, maybe that would be another way to put it, inspiration from the biological system when you build an artificial system of any kind. I think, again, outside my field, but I think one example that's for real is Velcro. So apparently, Velcro is biomimetic in the sense that it was inspired by, I believe, the foot pads of spiders that have, and maybe other insects. It might not have been spiders. It might have been another insect. I'm talking out of school. But it was one. It was some insect that basically has Velcro-like devices and uses them to climb walls and stick to things. And somebody got the brilliant idea and looked at this device. In this
microscopically.
Case, yeah, microscopically, and said, wait a minute. We can do this maybe on a larger scale. But but the principle should hold. We should draw. We should be able to draw that analogy from what we see on the foot pads of insects, let's say, and then we can create this material that will have this property of being able to stick and unstick repeatedly. And lo and behold, you have Velcro. That would be just sort of one example, right? Mm-hmm. So now, if you go to this project, the idea is that these nanoscale circuits that are being built are not trying to emulate perfectly any brain of any kind, human or otherwise. I mean, that's basically impossible at this point.
It's a nice goal to have, to like set that as the high bar to jump over.
Sure. That would be. But along the way, really what you're going to have to do is extract principles. Extract, you know, functional principles from the real system, and in a very simplified manner, and then, just like with Velcro, put them into, in this case, a nanoscale circuit, and hope that while, you know, Velcro didn't take the whole spider with it, or the whole foot for that matter, it just took this one idea. The same thing here. There's hope. The idea is that if we could get principles from neuroscience, but at a very, very simple level compared to what a neuroscientist would think of as, you know, a functioning nervous system, extract them and put them in a circuit, maybe we can get some, you know, some interesting behavior that you see in the real system that you've basically just taken the essence of it and put it into the artificial system.
Yeah. I'd love to know how you feel or your thoughts on neural networks and the idea of modeling these systems of or networks of neurons computationally versus this, I guess, with the synapse process project and the movement forward in neuroscience of understanding that so much activity goes on at the level of the synapse or the connection between two neurons.
Right.
Are people moving in the direction of synapse networks now as opposed to just neural networks?
So I guess the short answer would be yes. And let me kind of elaborate on it. So when you say neural networks and you contrast them with, I don't know, spiking networks, I think that's in my, at least in my field, what we would call, when you talk about the synapse being sort of something important in the action potential, basically sort of reaching a synapse and causing a, you know, electrochemical process and then that sort of occurring, you know, propagating further downstream. That we can contrast that idea with what you're saying is a neural network model, which I believe you're probably referring to, you know, circa 1980, 1970s, maybe the early 80s, where there were neural network models, computational models that were, I mean, you know, you could also say that they too were inspired by the nervous system, inspired by synapses, but at such a coarse level that essentially they were machine learning devices that had some very interesting properties and are continue to be used to this day, had units that looked like neurons. If you drew them on a piece of paper and you drew connections between them, you could sort of imagine that, you were looking at a neural network in the sense of, oh, there's neurons and there's synapses and, you know, there's activation or something like that being propagated across this network. But the basically those were so idealized and so sort of hard, really, truly just inspired by the nervous system, not actually modeling the nervous system in any way. And so that style of modeling has certainly, you know, lost popularity over the years. If that's, I don't know if that's what you're referring to, but that style of modeling has lost popularity.
So and, what's popular
yeah,
now?
So there's kind of two directions that that field has gone in. I'm sure there's more, but I'm going to just sort of roughly say two. One is to look at, is to basically take the machine learning part of the model more seriously and say, look, it's great to be inspired by neural networks, but if I want artificial intelligence in the sense that I just want an algorithm that can, you know, go through videotapes and recognize faces, let's just say that. You know, and I don't necessarily need to know how the brain does it. I don't need to know how real nervous systems and real neural networks do that. I can just pay attention to principles, computer science principles of machine learning, and I'll do a better job if I go that way, then if I sort of tie myself to trying to not only get it to work, but also get it to act like a real nervous system. So that's one route. You can sort of just break away from neural networks entirely and just do better machine learning.
Okay.
And there's a lot of that, you know, continues to go on, of course. The other route, I think, you know, long-winded way of getting back to where you, I think you started this, is to say, you know what? Let's do a better job of actually, you know, simulating the nervous system. Let's not just draw circles on a piece of paper and draw lines and kind of look like a neural network. Let's really, you know, let's look even more like a neural network and still tie it to function and behavior, right? So that's the key. Because there's always been models that are just about neuroscience.
Right.
That aren't basically necessarily trying to tie it to behavior. That you just want to understand how neurons work, and that's great. But in this case, I'm talking about models that are more closely tied to the nervous system and still trying to make contact with behavior and function. And these certainly do pay attention now to action potentials and to synaptic processes, for example.
Neat.
And that's what's going on in our project, is models of that quality, basically.
How do you take all of that into account? Are these different factors that are included in the overarching algorithm?
Right. Even when you say like all the parts of the nervous system, for example,
right.
How do you take it all into account?
Yeah.
So there is a sense, you basically make a bet. That's going to be the answer, the short answer.
Isn't that always this is where I'm going. I'm going to bet on this. Yes.
In this case, the field has, to a large degree, made a bet on the action potential, on the spike and the efficacy of synapses. In other words, the probability that when a spike reaches a synapse, what's the chance that it will propagate a spike in the next neuron? Okay,
right.
So the field has made a bet that that's where the action is for the most. I mean, we all know that, you know, not entirely, but a lot of the action lies right there. And so you only extract the factors that tell you about how often neurons spike, the timing of those spikes, you know, when two neurons spike in close succession with each other or, you know, out of phase with each other, right? This is the kind of information that you extract. And again, then also properties about how synapses change as spikes cross them, right? And this is where learning and adaptation would occur,
right?
Because it's basically in those synaptic changes that change the nature of the spikes and their timing and their rate, this is where all the action is. And you can basically leave all the other details behind. As long as you get that stuff right, you're in good shape. That may or may not be true. We have a lot. I mean, I'm probably being too flippant. I mean, we have a lot of evidence to suggest that indeed there is a lot of action going on. You know, when I say action, I mean you can connect behavior and function to the nervous system at this level. Spikes, their timing, their rates, and the synaptic efficacies.
So
it's a bet, but it's, you know, it's a good bet. I mean, it's an educated bet. You know, but who knows? We may sort of go down the road and find out that there's a whole molecular level of process going on in the nervous system that we actually do need to bring with us in order to get anything about function and behavior. And we just don't know yet.
Yeah. At the same time, there's the question of, you know, what is sufficient? Yeah. So in order to get behaviors that they're close enough,
yeah,
they work, you know, you have a synthetic brain cortex that's processing information, information in, behavior out, making decisions. You know, if you can approximate that with these rules, is that sufficient? It's not using maybe those molecular aspects.
Right. It really just depends on what your goal is, right? I mean,
yeah.
I would say already today there are models that are sufficient in the sense that you can, for example, you can build a spiking neural network of the class that I just sort of described, mm-hmm. and you can put it in a robot. People have done this already. You can put it in a robot and at the very least get that robot to navigate and avoid bumping into obstacles. Just one small example. So if your goal was to get that level of performance, that level, you just needed something to you know, a circuit that basically helps you not bump into things. Which, by the way, I mean, it may sound really ridiculous.
I need that circuit.
Don't we all?
Help.
Then, you know what? We already have it. I mean, we can already answer the question. Yeah, the spikes are sufficient. Whether spikes are going to be sufficient for planning routes, whether spikes are going to be sufficient for language, I don't think we know that yet.
Yeah, how does it scale up as you add more complex behaviors?
Right.
Yeah.
That's certainly part of the goal of this project is to, you know, as we go along to, you know, make advances on that front. But at this point in time, I think, you know, we haven't talked too much about the hardware side of this project, and I guess you might have other...
In a couple of weeks, I'm going to be speaking with Dharmendra Moda from IBM, and he's going to be talking about the advances in the chip side, the technology side, how that's growing.
So I'll certainly won't steal his thunder, let him talk about that. But
you can tease it a little bit, that's okay.
But I just wanted to raise it because... what's happened, you know, the project really, a lot of the effort right now is going into that side of the project. And we're basically very in early days, as I think I've already kind of said, early days on the functional behavior side of the project. So it's not like I can tell you now after only a short bit of time working on this that, yes, we can, you know, it's sufficient. Spikes are sufficient for language planning, you know, complex navigation. We don't know yet.
Right. And how much of what you're doing right now is reliant on the advances in the technology? Can you move forward at a good pace without the technology moving with you? Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. So right from the very beginning, it was crucial for this project to work at all, to allow things, basically these different aspects of the project to move forward in parallel. Which means that you can't necessarily wait entirely for the hardware. Now, I know mm-hmm. I just said that, you know, a lot of the effort's being put there, and it is. But some effort certainly has been put on the circuit side and then on the virtual environment side.
Mm-hmm.
And basically the way we can move forward without the hardware being there yet is that we can simulate the hardware, right? So we can basically, because, you know, we can basically say, well, if we think the hardware is going to work like this, let's just quickly write up some code that... And now when I say, maybe I should use the word emulate. Like
emulate,
exactly does what the hardware will do. So
except
that,
maybe not as fast. Like you're still dealing with modern computers
Absolutely.
Single circuits and not able to do massively parallel.
That's
unless
you're
working with a supercomputer.
Which Dharmendra will tell you about. So there's certainly, there's a lot of that going on in the project. But you're absolutely right that it's, you're not gaining the benefits.
You're still limited.
You're not getting the benefits that the hardware will hopefully provide for you, both in terms of speed. And then you kind of alluded to this at the beginning of the show. Most importantly, really, I think for us, is power. I mean, the idea that you can have something so small and require so little power that basically you never need to have a battery. Maybe just a very simple little solar cell will be able to run this thing for in perpetuity. That would be quite something. So you don't, no, we don't have that at this point. But in terms of trying to run ahead and say, is this going to work? Is the circuit going to actually do something for us? We can do that now. Yeah.
That's amazing. So. I think that's the neat thing, is being able to actually, like you said, emulate the system that you, so we're not there yet, but oh, let's make it up in the virtual environment. Right. We can make it happen. The idea of scaling and mm-hmm. how, I guess the size of the brain to the amount of processing power that you have, or the amount of cognitive power you have. So can you tell me a little bit about the 1 over F scaling property? I've been looking around.
Yeah,
and
I
saw it, and it just, uh-huh. just this phrase, 1 over F, it doesn't make any sense.
Right. So I'm happy to tell you about 1 over F, but we're changing gears a little bit.
We're changing
so
gears?
You know, we are okay. Just a little bit. You asked the question, I'll say a few words about it. In fact, I can kind of tie it back mm-hmm. to this project, but... You've done your homework. You've seen that I have this stuff on my website. That's kind of another part of my life. It's yes. sort of, but I mean, hey, I'm
it's
one
all
person.
Tied together.
It's all tied together.
It's all
somehow,
tied
right?
together. You are so, the common denominator.
Right. I'm somehow the common denominator. Yeah. But yes, like many, you know, academics, we have lots of different projects going mm-hmm. on, you know, and so here's another one. So the scaling in that phrase is different than scaling in terms of scaling up from small numbers of neurons to lots and lots of neurons to, you know, billions and trillions of synapses, for example.
Right.
The word scaling there has a very different meaning. So first of all, let's just sort of put that aside. Like, okay, there's scaling in terms of, you know, scaling up your systems in this, you know, Synaptronics project. And then there's this other kind of scaling. Now, it's a little abstract, so I'll just give you a flavor of it. You can take almost any complex system in the universe that we know of, quasars, biological systems of any kind, quantum systems of various kinds, mm-hmm. Sufficiently complicated electrical circuits, electronic circuits. And basically, as they're behaving, you can put them in a state that is more or less what we could call allow them to intrinsically fluctuate. In other words, what's their behavior if they're just sitting there idling?
Okay.
You know, like imagine the engine of a car. Mm-hmm. And it's just idling, and you sort of are listening to the idle, and you're trying to get information about the car. Like, and mechanics do this, right? A mechanic could listen to the idle of a car and diagnose something about that car. So you could imagine something like that with any given complex system. And in this case, let's imagine human behavior.
Yeah.
So now the question is, how do I get you to idle, right? How do I get you to sort of give me this, you know, so if I'm the mechanic, how do I get you to idle and give me this sort of hum and then diagnose or at least try to learn something about you as a system, right? Turns out there's very easy ways to do it. I can just get you to repeat some behavior. So, you know, tap your finger over and over. Just keep tapping your finger. Or say a word. Yeah, there you go. Tap, tap, tap. Say a word over and over again until you sort of like are being driven crazy by saying this word.
Or you're numb to it. Or you become numb to it.
You become numb to it. Yeah, and there are certainly effects of that. It's called satiation. But so you can do this, and then what's going to happen is your behavior is going to fluctuate. You know, every time you tap, it's not going to be the exact same tap. Because we're biological organisms. We're not machines. We don't sort of behave to the nth degree of precision. We are kind of noisy, right? And you'd think of, if you don't know any more than that, you might think it's noise in the boring sense of the word. In other words, get rid of it. It's noise. It's just random variation. The wind's blowing. You know, there's a little, you know, earthquake there, and it kind of caused me to tap a little bit differently, blah, 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 so on. Turns out that variation is not noise in that sense. It's actually highly characteristic. There's a lot of regularity to it, a lot of complex regularity to it, and it has a name called 1 over F scaling. So I know it took me a while to get there, but it's the name 1 over F scaling is a statistical phrase for describing the fluctuations that you would see in this case in human behavior. But you can get neurons, by the way. You can get neurons to give you intrinsic fluctuations. In other words, I can have mm-hmm. you sit in a... let's say a electrophysiological recording device, EEG.
EEG,
okay?
Right.
Or I can even have you sit in a blood oxygen level dependent device, which is called fMRI, mm-hmm. functional magnetic resonance imaging, and I can have your brain idle. I can have it sit there and hum. Basically, sit look at, you know, you're in the device.
Just stare,
I put the cap
something.
On, stare, yep. Daydream, do whatever you need to do just for a few minutes, and I'm going to take some recordings. It turns out that in many ways of looking at those kinds of data, you get the same hum. This 1/f scaling hum that's not random. It has a lot of structure to it. It's the same kind of structure over and over and over again in all these different systems. And so the question is why? What is it telling you?
Yeah, about what is the significance?
What's the significance of that? That is a very controversial topic. I mean, I have a very strong bias, but you know, this is where, you know, when I go to conferences and, you know, if you can imagine academics getting, professors getting into fights, this is the kind of thing that people fight about.
I love it.
This is where you get really, people kind of get charged, at least certainly in my area of, you know, cognitive science and experimental psychology. It's something that has been only recently really appreciated and recognized. And now the debate is on, the fight is on, basically. For the next, I don't know how many years we'll go through this, we're going to see where this leads, because now it took a little while to just get the field to sort of recognize that it exists. This is real. This is not. Mm-hmm. This is not a mistake.
You know, right. This isn't just an artifact in the data.
Exactly, yeah. It's not an artifact. Scientists are very conservative, as they should be, and so when something unusual comes along and unexpected, the first reaction is to be skeptical, right? To say there's something wrong here. Fix your equipment, figure out what you did wrong, and come back and tell us.
Go test your stuff.
Come back when you have the boring kind of noise that we thought we would see. And then a lot of results now, it's very clear. I don't think anybody who knows about this phenomenon would disagree. It's there. So now we've gotten to that stage. And now the next stage is trying to figure out what it's telling us about brains and about human behavior. So you can see, obviously, those you know, topics are related to the Synapse
Absolutely.
Project. But again, it's not like I'm doing that work in the Synapse Project. I'm doing that work funded separately and just, you know, this is a separate part of my life.
Right. It's a separate part of your life, but it is going to inform a lot of your ideas. And as data comes forward, it may change how you look at behavioral problems for the synthetic brain.
I can tell you, I mean, there is a one connection I can make. It's not going to be through 1/f, but if you just sort of trust me, in this project, one very important aspect of building any kind of spiking circuit is that it has a property of stability. Now, what does stability mean in this case? Basically, spikes, right? These sort of, you know, these pulses of a voltage differential in the nervous system, and they'll actually look a lot like that in the nanoscale circuits as well. These pulses come in and you could have two bad situations where, remember early on I said, you know, we're just trying to get things not to crash.
Yeah.
Well, this is what I'm talking about, getting it just not to crash, okay? You can have two bad situations where you crash. One is you basically, the spikes don't propagate enough through the system. So if you remember, we talked about neurons and then action potential, the spike going to the synapse. And the question is, are you going to get a synapse on the next neuron? And then is that going to give you another synapse on the next neuron and so on, right? If that process doesn't give you enough synapses, they don't propagate enough, you'll have a system that's dead. That's more or less dead tissue. You try to give it input, you try to kick it and get it to, you know, compute, do something for you, and it doesn't respond. It just basically dies out every time. That's bad. You also don't want a system that if you touch it, it goes wild.
It goes wild.
Crazy. And spikes start.
Epileptic seizure.
Yes, epileptic seizure is a classic example. That's right. Yeah. So you don't want that either. You want some balance between the two. Now, this is a well-known problem. We don't, you know, people don't need to know about 1/f scaling to understand this problem. But it turns out, and this is not just, I've done some work in this myself, but it's not just me, that you can basically express that idea of stability in a way that connects it with 1/f scaling in a way that basically says systems that are nicely, perfectly balanced in this stable place where they don't die and they don't go wildfire will, turns out, very sort of generically, and who knows, maybe even universally, it's too early to say that, but at least for now, often, generally, give you 1/f scaling. And so maybe something about 1/f scaling is telling you something about a system that's nicely balanced and nicely stable.
Yeah, that actually will keep the system running and actually maintain it so that you're not
Exactly. Yeah. Basically, not crash, right? So, but, yeah. You know, and this would make sense because I remember I told you earlier that, you know, you see this everywhere. It's like one over scaling is sort of anytime you measure these systems, they give you that behavior. And so, hey, it would make sense that this property would be related to the plumbing of the system, right? Something yeah. really basic, not specialized, something just
not
really...
Not like consciousness, maybe, that the overarching,
right.
you know,
and
the
funny.
Ultimate goal
That's
but,
right.
of understanding,
right.
But something much more basic.
Much more basic, yeah. So that right. I think that's at least certainly where, you know, I've put my bets and at least I'm sort of pursuing that possibility. I may be proven wrong and that's fine. And like I said, there are lots of alternative views out there that the battle is on to yeah. sort of figure it out.
So final question as we're getting to the end of the yeah. show here. You mentioned earlier that you probably don't think that the synthetic brain or the artificial brain right. that you're creating will mimic or be the same as a human brain. What factors do you think are involved in that? And do you think it will end up becoming its own kind of intelligence?
Right. So Kurzweil has this idea of a singularity, right?
Yes.
Some moment either in the internet or in some sufficiently large and complex system that at some point
yep.
you will get something like you mentioned the C consciousness.
You're creating a brain. You're
yeah.
teaching it how to think.
Right, right.
You're giving it all the tools. Now
right.
you're basically creating synthetic synapses, the
right.
circuits that are going to be used. I mean, unless we're missing something, you'd think.
Right.
What's going to come out of it?
Right. You know, it's funny. Look, first of all, let me say this, that in being trained as a cognitive scientist and psychologist, we are trained to never go near consciousness, to never ever think
don't
about
even
it.
Even touch it
don't
with a 10-foot pole.
Look at it. It's because, and the reason is that it's basically because it's not observable, it's not testable. How do you know? I mean, I should say there is the classic test that has, you know, since been mostly discredited is the Turing test.
Right.
So, you know, for everybody, the Turing test is simply if you've got consciousness, then you should be able to fool somebody into thinking you're human, right?
Yes.
So I should be able to basically put, for example, the classic version of that test is you sit in front of a keyboard and you start typing. You can imagine like an IM chat. And on the other side is either a real person
mm-hmm.
or an artificial intelligence. And you basically ask questions. You interact through the IM chat. And if the artificial intelligence fools you, then not only is it like, you know, basically passed the Turing test and has human cognition, you might even go so far as to say that, okay, it's got consciousness.
Right.
Right? Because, I mean, how else could it be fooling me? And the problem is, how else are we going to know? How else are we going to know except by comparison, by basically just, because we don't, I have no way, I don't think anybody does, has any way to sort of tell you what, how to measure consciousness and what it is or something like
I mean,
that.
This question goes yeah. back to like Plato and
yeah.
Aristotle
well,
and
big time, yeah.
you know, how do I know that anyone other than right. myself is conscious?
Oh yes,
you know,
philosophers, yeah,
this is the conundrum.
There's an entire field of philosophy
yes.
on this. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so, mm-hmm. so the question, yeah. The question is, you know, do
yeah.
you, I guess the question from here beyond even, you know, okay, we won't be able to know whether or not it's conscious. It would probably fool us anyway,
right.
especially if it were conscious. And, but do you think it might, with the learning that,
yeah.
that you give it, even if you give it human-based learning,
yeah.
would it, do you think it might veer off and become its own kind of intelligence?
Let me just rephrase that ever so slightly in a way that now you can, I think you potentially could start answering the question and at least thinking about it, which is, will it surprise you? Will it give you novel behavior? Will it do something that it seems on its own accord that you
yeah.
did not, had no expectation. You didn't even come close to programming it. You didn't think it was going to happen. And lo and behold, it happens. That I think is very possible.
Yeah.
I mean, that's already happened in some sense, not with our project, but in previous projects. I think to me, in my sort of upbringing in this in academics is, again, I think it's right around the 80s when artificial life, something called artificial life, came along. And basically what happened is that people simulated evolution, natural selection in a computer, and surprising things happened. Basically, yeah. In this case, creatures evolved to move in their environment in some medium. So you set up, it's much like a very, very simple virtual environment. In fact, you set up physics, you set up some rules for how the environment works, and you set up a fitness function. In other words, what it means for a critter to do well in mm-hmm. that environment. And then you basically iterate, in other words, repeat a process of natural selection. You say the critters that survive the longest, that do best, they get to pass on their genes, right? And I would say some very surprising, I mean, there were ways of locomoting, in other words, ways of moving through that environment that nobody even envisioned were possible.
Wow.
These critters figured out. They found these ways that were just truly gave you the sense of surprise and delight. But, and I think, you know, I know that sounds very subjective, but hey, we are talking about consciousness. This is somewhat of a subjective thing. I mean, I think, and you can measure surprise and delight, and at least I can ask you, or rate on a scale of 1 to 10, was that surprising and delightful? and yeah, I would say that is certainly novel, what happened in those kinds of environments. And I think we can very much expect the same kind of thing to happen eventually, with these kinds of circuits, because again, the same factors are at play. You've got an environment. You've got mechanisms of adaptation. We're not necessarily using natural selection and, you know, a genetic algorithm, but that's fine. We're using, you know, something called synaptic timing dependent plasticity and other mechanisms. But the point is, surprising things can happen, and they in uninteresting ways they do every day.
Right.
But one day, maybe something interesting, something surprising and interesting. I don't think it'll be consciousness, but it'll be a behavior that's novel, and who knows, maybe, you know, smarter than you could have imagined. I do believe that.
Wow. I think that's a great point to end on. This has been such a fascinating conversation, and I could probably keep asking questions for the next couple of hours. Definitely. So thank you so much for joining us here.
It's
on
a pleasure.
Yes, thank you. On Dr. Kiki Science Hour, and for all the information about the behavioral and cognitive side of Synapse, this DARPA-funded project, and also information on teaching computers how to think. Be sure to visit CogMech. Let me put it up on the board here. If you want more information on Dr. Kello's laboratory, you can visit CogMech. That's CogMech.ucmerced.edu. Several of his papers, publications are online for download as PDFs. And there's other information as well. You can go to the UC Merced Cognitive Science Department, which is cogsci.ucmerced.edu. And then if you wanted to, you could go check out the DARPA website as well, because, you know, DARPA's doing a lot of the funding of this stuff, and they have some interesting ideas written down on the interwebs out there. Beyond that, thank you all for watching. This has been Dr. Kiki Science Hour. If you are interested in downloading this program, you can find it online at twit.tv/Kiki, or you can find it in the iTunes Science Directory or in the Twit Network iTunes Directory. Additionally, we are now available online, YouTube, as video. We're also a video podcast download now, and you can find us on the Roku and the Boxy Box. Dr. Kiki Science Hour is everywhere. I am spreading like artificial intelligence. It's good. You can contact me at drkiki@twit.tv if you need to send me an email for questions or future suggestions for interview subjects. I'd love to hear from you. Additionally, you can tweet me. I'm at Dr. Kiki, DRKIKI. Thanks for watching. Back here, same time, same place next week, 3 to 4 p.m. Pacific time on Thursdays for Science Thursdays. And if nothing else, this last hour of science just made your world a whole lot more interesting.